Dit is Leaders in Life Sciences, een podcast waarin we op zoek gaan naar het verhaal achter de mens. We praten met leiders van nu en later over wat hun drijft, hun carrière en hun privéleven. Want door naar elkaar te luisteren, komen we als individu en als sector verder. We willen onze partners hartelijk bedanken voor hun steun. Dat zijn Pivot Park, Johnson & Johnson Innovative Medicine en Pedersen & Partners Executive Search. De gast in deze aflevering is Anish Mehta. Host is Henk-Jan Oud.
Welcome everybody, thanks for listening. Today's guest was born in Chicago, trained as a biomedical engineer, and he joined the pharmaceutical industry in 1995. He had various positions in sales, marketing, and business development in companies like Ospira, Baxter, Actavis, and Allergan. He moved to Europe and became CEO of Theramex, a London-based women's health company, and subsequently joined the Dutch company Synton in 2021 as its CEO. He's still based in London and is commuting to Nijmegen, where Synton's headquarters is located, and to the many affiliations of this generic company. His Dutch is a bit rusty, so we agreed to do this podcast in English instead of Dutch. So welcome, Anish, and thanks for coming to us at the Pivot Park.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, most of your professional career has been in the generics industry. So tell me, how did you get there? You were trained as a biomedical engineer.
That's right. Well, you know, I was fortunate enough to be kind of part of a pharmaceutical family. You know, I grew up in Chicago, and my father was a chemical engineer, and my father worked in pharmaceuticals. So I was lucky enough that during my summer breaks that I had the opportunity to work in a pharmaceutical company called Abbott Labs. And that was really my kind of first exposure to the industry.
What sort of work did you do there?
Well, I did some painting. I did some moving things around in a warehouse.
Very generic things, basically. Yeah.
Very generic things. And, you know, it was a great program where they had kids of employees come in, and they wanted to kind of give them an introduction to a very important industry. And I have to say, it was kind of fun. Lots of my friends were there. And I said, these companies are kind of cool. I never thought about it when my dad was there, but then actually going in there and doing a bit of work, it's kind of a nice thing to do. And that's really how I got started. And one summer internship led to another summer internship. And then as I was studying engineering, you know, I really was sort of thinking about, do I want to be a doctor or do I want to work in the industry? And I knew I loved the whole sciences and mathematics, but I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And some of those experiences kind of led me towards getting my first job at Abbott in the, you know, in the pharma industry.
As an engineer.
So that was a bit different than doing painting and moving boxes
Absolutely,
around.
Yeah.
And as a young engineer, I had the opportunity to work in different factories and kind of see how the products were made and work on equipment and work on kind of process chemistry. And I spent a number of years doing that. And, you know, I came out of that with two very strong conclusions. One was that I really loved the industry and I loved the purpose-driven mindset and the impact that it has on people. And number two, I learned I was a terrible engineer and that I needed to find something else to do in the industry.
And what was that?
Well, I wanted to kind of move to the business side. Right. I saw some colleagues that were doing sales and doing marketing and business development. You know, the whole pharma healthcare industry is really about collaboration. No single company can do everything on their own. And I saw these people that were like working with other companies, with research institutions, with universities. And I'm like, that's actually pretty interesting. Like, I'm a people person. I love, you know, engaging with people. I'm an extrovert. So I decided to go and do my MBA. So I left my job and I went to the University of Pennsylvania, the Wharton School, to do my MBA in strategic management and finance. And it was, you know, very different than engineering, and it really kind of rounded out my, let's say, academic experiences. And from there, I said I want to stay kind of in healthcare, but I needed to find a way to transition. And that's when I ended up joining McKinsey, which is the management consulting firm.
Right. So did your engineering background help you somehow in your activities at McKinsey, or was it completely useless at the end?
Yeah, it's a good question. So engineering, at least at the U.S. universities, engineering is, I would say there's two very important parts of it. One of them is it teaches you how to structure problems. It's very much an analytical approach to how you think of something complex, make it simple, and then use data to answer the question. And then the second one is obviously the more technical things, like, you know, thermodynamics and, yeah, all those kinds of things. And it's the first one that's really, frankly, relevant to almost everything, and especially in consulting, where you're working with clients, you're working on different kinds of problems that you're trying to solve, and ultimately it all kind of comes down to the same thing. How do you take something that's big and complex and multifaceted and break it down into what really matters? And I think that's really what my education helped me do.
Yeah. I can also imagine as a biomedical engineer that will help you in also in the generics business, where lots of it is about improving efficiency of manufacturing, and then that knowledge might be quite helpful.
Yeah, exactly. And again, to do biomedical engineering, I had to study biology, chemistry, physics. So really, really understanding the basic sciences. Yeah. And all of that obviously is the foundation of pharmaceuticals and generics. So that fundamental part, and then of course the engineering part about looking at efficiencies and you know, scaling things up. And again, you know, how do you make things at the right quality more efficient? And that's really where the engineering kind of part of the brain kicks in.
Right. So you joined McKinsey. It's quite interesting. Many of our guests here in the podcast started at McKinsey and then, you know, found themselves back at a startup or another pharmaceutical company. So the same thing happened with you, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's one of those places where it's a fantastic learning ground. And the whole company is set up where they just attract and hire ambitious, smart people that have either MBAs or technical backgrounds, and they just continue the learning journey. So while you're contributing to helping clients, you know, improve their businesses or solve difficult problems, you're learning at the same time, and you're, you know, advancing that whole problem-solving skill set, how to do presentations. I mean, this is one of the things that people really underestimate, that in university, like, no one really teaches you how to do a presentation. I mean, you're studying numbers or sciences or whatever and doing tests. But in the real world, it's all about how do you convey an idea, right? How do you get other people to understand? And McKinsey is fantastic at that. So I did that for a number of years, and I was focused mostly in healthcare and life sciences.
One of the fantastic things there, I think, is probably that you also can look at the kitchen of many of the different industries, see how they deal with the different issues and how they solve it. So you get a very broad background giving final advice to your clients.
That's right, and it's both from the functional point of view and the industry point of view. So you could be working in the automotive industry or the airline industry or pharmaceutical industry, but also you could be working on supply chain or sales and marketing or a new product launch. And I was lucky enough to have a number of those experiences where I got to see, you know, the kitchen, as you call it, for a bunch of companies. And then you start to really figure out what good looks like. And again, I think a career is, it's not a series of destinations. I mean, a career is kind of a meandering journey, and every time you have a job, the idea is contribute, you know, be productive and learn. And that's kind of what I've always, that's my mantra. Just like, how, if I'm not learning anymore, it might be time for me to do something different.
So you took all that learning experience to your first real pharmaceutical company, and that was which company again?
Yeah, so actually I went back to Abbott. So right, after I did McKinsey, I went back to Abbott. I was actually recruited back to Abbott by somebody I used to work for, and in this situation, it was in a sales and marketing job, and I think that kind of started the second part of my career, which was really back in the healthcare industry, but now in the side that I wanted to be on, which was sales and marketing and business development, and I was lucky enough then to have a series of roles where I was doing actual sales, I was doing marketing, I was doing strategy. And I was engaging with patients, I was engaging with physicians, looking at new products. And again, all of this like confirmed my my belief, which was this is my passion. And I said, okay, now this is the industry. Like, I love the industry. I love the people in the industry and the impact. And that's kind of how that second part of my career started to evolve.
Oh. And particularly business development, you've done a lot, right?
I have.
Because you've made some very big deals in your professional life, I believe.
I have. So some may you know, call me a deal junkie. I would say I'm not a deal junkie, but I certainly enjoy doing deals. And I think it's back to what I said earlier. This industry really is one of collaboration. I mean, it is not possible, given the complexity of the science, the cost of bringing products to market, the cost of marketing them. It's not possible to do it on your own. So, you know, how you collaborate and how you do deals is just super important. And I've always had this sort of win-win philosophy. It's not about, you know, how do I get the best deal possible, but it's about how do you create an environment where everyone feels like they get something out of it. And, you know, over the course of my career, I started doing, you know, kind of smaller licensing deals where you pay some money to bring a product in. I out-licensed some deals, sold assets, bought assets, and ultimately ended up doing a lot of buying and selling of companies, like whole companies, some from families, some public companies. And so I've been lucky in my career to have kind of the full arsenal of loads of different types of deals. And each one is different. You know, size doesn't mean it's harder or less hard. It's really the environment, who you're buying it from, that determines the complexity.
It also became part of the identity of pharmaceutical industries, I think, because in the past, every big industry did their own research, their own development. They did everything on their own, but that idea shifted into let's do things together, and if somebody else can do it better, let's buy that company or try to make a deal. That whole mindset has shifted, I think.
Exactly. And I think you have two sides of this coin. One of them is in generics, and one of them is in the more kind of innovative side of medicine. And the innovative side of medicine, I think the larger companies were getting so big, they realized they needed to find new sources of innovation. And the more they started buying, the more there were companies popping up with smart scientists who had great ideas, and they were just accelerating the pace of innovation. So more and more deals were happening. And now, you know, it is just such an enormous source of new products and new ideas for the large companies because they want to complement what they can do on their own with these kind of agile, nimble companies. And then you flip to the other side, which is generics. And you know, after I finished doing some of these more innovative things is when I moved into the generics industry in 2010. And I joined a company called Watson Pharmaceuticals. And Watson was a U.S.-based generics company that was kind of on the verge of globalizing because the generics industry was really taking off and the need for high quality, affordable medicines was just almost unlimited. So companies like Watson that were still scientifically focused, had a real commitment to quality, had a huge demand. And that was also fueling our kind of growth aspirations. And we ended up doing a lot of growth through acquisitions. And we bought a company in the UK, and then we bought a company in Greece, then we bought another company in Iceland. And one thing led to another, partly to fuel this the supply for the demand that was there. And the other thing was around what it takes to be successful in generics, which is scale.
Because I got the impression that those consolidations particularly took place a lot in the generic industry.
That's right. They took place in the generics industry, again, to drive scale and cost of goods. And you just had this kind of market phenomena where the demand was increasing so much, but at the same time, the pressure on pricing was just so high, and that's actually something that hasn't changed, right? The pressure to produce product at the lowest possible price is so fierce that you just have to be a scale player.
Why is that? I always wonder. So much happening with drugs. I mean, I don't see that price pressure of many other goods that people are using, but it's somehow we have this idea that drugs need to be as cheap as possible, and we go into length and great efforts to actually make that happening to such an extent that we now have shortages. Why do we think that medicine, perhaps you can explain what it is to make a generic, because that's not so easy, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, to make a generic, a lot of people think it's just a straight copy of something that's on the market, anybody can do it, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not the reality of it. I mean, at the end of the day, it's still a pharmaceutical product that goes into the human body or a patient, and it needs to have the intended effect, whether it's something for the heart or the thyroid or the kidney or whatever it may be. You know, you want to make sure, and you need to make sure, that the patient getting the product is getting the therapeutic benefit from this medication. So in order to do that, the generic companies have to go through a whole development process where they are working on the science, they are doing the testing, they're manufacturing the product in the real conditions, they're testing the storage and stability conditions. Because, you know, when you read the packaging on a medication and it says store it at a certain temperature, not everyone does. So you have to make sure that if they store it in a warmer temperature or a colder temperature, or if they use it longer or shorter, that it's still going to be okay and not cause any harm to the patient. Then you have to do testing to make sure that it actually behaves in the same way that the innovator product behaves. And you do that. It's called bioequivalence testing. You do that in healthy volunteers to make sure that, again, it's getting the desired effect. So when you put all that stuff together, each individual drug will still cost millions of euros to develop. And then you have to get it registered, and then you have to make it available. There's regulatory fees because, of course, the regulatory agencies have to evaluate all the data and make sure that it is what it says. Now, of course, it's an industry that has a very, very high ethical standard. So we are self-policing in a way that, you know, as an industry, we're not submitting data or we're not trying to get drugs approved that shouldn't be. But at the same time, you always need a check and balance. And then the whole manufacturing conditions of how you ensure the right quality, how you ensure the right consistency, you know, something called GMP, good manufacturing practices, which sets a very, very high standard, as it should. So when you put all that stuff together, I think your listeners should feel very comfortable that, you know, when they go to the pharmacy, whether it's in the Netherlands or in the UK or wherever it is, that whatever generic medication they're getting has been made under the right conditions, it's gone through the right testing, and that they should feel very, very comfortable that it will do what it says it does. And it's taken some years to get to that, right? Because it's kind of a new industry still, but I'm very comfortable, having been doing this for now 30 years, that, you know, we're at the right place that we should be. And you know, we have a very real positive effect on patients.
And yet, then we have pills at the pharmacy that are even cheaper than the packaging sometimes. How is that possible?
Yeah, and that's the great conundrum of this industry, which is exactly that. I mean, you know, you can go out and buy a cup of Starbucks or buy a bottle of water, and it might cost more than what the actual full manufactured and packaged cost of that pharmaceutical product is. And I think that the whole idea of affordable medicines, right? We call it generics, but the idea is that this is affordable medicines. And the number one objective is that it's helping to drive access for patients. So patients who couldn't normally afford something that will cost 1,000 euros a month or 100 euros a month are now able to get the medication they need because it's made available through these generic alternatives. So the market is so attractive that lots of companies look to do the same thing, and then it just becomes fiercely competitive. And in Europe, you have normally the government is the buyer or the payer, and they see the dynamic and they say, well, if we can use tenders or we can use other purchasing mechanisms to drive the price down, then we're going to be able to buy more for our, you know, for our constituents, and et cetera, et cetera. So it makes sense conceptually, but at some point where I think we took our eye off the ball is there needs to be a floor. Because on one hand, what I described is a very high cost of development and a very high cost of maintaining the right level of quality. You know, this isn't a piece of candy or a tissue. It's something that's going into your body. But on the other hand, we want it at the cheapest price possible. And as you said, this has caused shortages. And shortages are the worst thing that can happen because patients need the medication.
But before we go into that, how is it possible that the generics industry is still profitable? If you have prices lower than the packaging, how can you ever be profitable?
You know, it's a portfolio game. So what ends up happening is that you have individual products that are not profitable, and then you have other products that are profitable. And this is why the scale concept is so important, that you have to have a large portfolio of products. You have to have the scale so that you can manufacture at the most cost-effective way. You have to be able to have a good procurement organization that allows you to, again, you know, the components you buy, you can buy them at the most cost-effective prices. And then you put it together. And every European country, or frankly, every country around the world, will have a slightly different procurement model. And some markets, you're able to make a little bit more money faster. Some a little bit more money for longer. Some markets, you might not make any money from the very beginning. And I think that's really what the successful generics companies, and like Synthon, that's kind of what we do, is we really have to look at the big picture and say, we're still purpose-driven, so we always want to make sure that we bring the first available generic to market, because, you know, getting patients that access and driving market access is important to us, but we still run a company. So we've got to do it in a way that we're managing different markets and different products. Yeah.
So now we get all our, so we end up now with getting all our active pharmaceutical ingredients from China and India, right? And let's go a little bit into the shortages. So what do you think is the cause for that shortage, and what should we do about it?
Yeah. You know, I think the corona pandemic taught us a lot about the importance of global supply chains, about onshore and nearshore manufacturing. So again, terms in the industry, you know, if it's onshore and nearshore, it's kind of in continental Europe, let's say. But I'm sad to say that it taught us a lot for a few minutes, because even though we were experiencing these shortages and people weren't getting everything from toilet paper to pharmaceuticals, there was a lot of talk about this, and then nothing really happened. And I think it's just being very short-sighted, because ultimately the APIs that come from India and China are made at vast scales. And the scale of manufacturing is what allows them to have a low cost. And in an environment where you're dealing with price erosion of 90%, 95%, 99% from the brand price,
From the
original price when there was still the patent on it, you know, companies in the generics industry have got to think about, how do you deal with that, and how do you ensure that you can still maintain all the investment required for the quality and the regulatory and compliance perspectives, and still make a little bit of money?
Yeah, there are still quite a lot of generic companies, aren't there? So it's still quite interesting to get into that business.
It's still interesting to get into the business. It's tougher and tougher, because of this whole scale concept and the portfolio concept. Entering the generics industry with a couple of products is very difficult to do, almost impossible. And that's why you see all this consolidation, and you see the ones that are winning are generally the larger companies, or the ones that have some kind of a specialized angle.
Yeah. So how many products go off patent every year that might be of interest of a generics industry?
Yeah. So there's about 60 or 70 products that lose exclusivity every year, or their patent protection every year. So, you know, throughout the US and Europe, you see these products, which includes all kinds. You know, there's some biologics that are now biosimilars. There are small molecules. There are different kinds of products that are losing this exclusivity. And it's always a race for a lot of generics companies to essentially have a product ready at that loss of exclusivity.
So they start as early as possible, I suppose.
Yeah. They start as early as possible, exactly. And again, I think that's really what the whole infrastructure is geared up for, that because, you know, the payers or the NHS in the UK or the other government payers are really looking for the generic product on the first available day. because, again, it allows them to manage their budgets and ultimately allows more patients to get on the product. So I think the structure of the market is correct. It's just that we've gone a bit overboard on this whole cheaper thing. And you said it before, whether it's packaging material, it's the manufacturing, it's the product itself. You know, there are very important products for lowering cholesterol, statins, for example, or anti-infectives, or, you know, things like omeprazole for, you know, when you have reflux. The price that a manufacturing company sells it at could be €2 for one pack. Imagine €2. Now, of course, there's a lot of people in the value chain, so €2 is not what the patient pays. The patient may pay more if it's not, you know, covered by the government. But just the idea that a company that has to maintain a highest level of standards and quality and compliance in a highly regulated market needs to produce something at less than €2 and not lose money is kind of a head scratcher. Yeah. And if you haven't walked around factories and you haven't been in this industry, you kind of think to yourself, should a cup of coffee really cost more than a life-saving therapy? And in the industry, we always say no. So we work very closely with Medicines for Europe. So that's kind of the industry association that the generics industry works with to try and influence policy across the EU, just to make sure we can focus on sustainability, right? Quality is paramount. That's never going to suffer. But what we want is to maintain sustainability. We want more development of local companies, local manufacturing, but you can't have it both ways, right? You can't have the cheapest possible price, but also want to have the quality and talent of European manufacturing. And that's always the push and pull.
So if we want to minimize our dependence on China and India for our APIs, that means that we have to invest in Europe, and that's going to cost money, and that undoubtedly will increase the price of these generics. That's the only way to deal with it if you want to, you know, get rid of countries like China and India, perhaps even the United States in the future.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's really minimizing the dependence. It's not getting rid of it completely, because there are certain things that you just need to scale. Yeah. But I think just for security of supply, for kind of health security, many, many countries are going in this direction. We do a lot of work in the Middle East, and places like Saudi Arabia are very focused on health security. And they're putting a lot of money to work to say, in the next 10 or 15 years, we want to reduce our dependence on the East and the West. We want to do development here. We want to do manufacturing here. We want to be able to control it. And I think finding that balance for Europe is very important as well. To say,
see any movement into the direction?
I think it's pretty slow. It's pretty slow, to be honest. Now, companies like Synthon, we've always been committed to manufacturing in Europe. So we have two large manufacturing sites, one in the Czech Republic and one in Spain. And honestly, it's been a real competitive advantage for us. Now, of course, the cost of manufacturing in Europe is higher than India or China. We've already talked about that. But what we try and do is we leverage the skill sets we have. We leverage the talent that we have. So that portfolio concept, we work on different kinds of products that will allow us to have perhaps a slight pricing premium and allows us to be a profitable company. And yep, that strategy is not right for everyone, but for a company like ours, whose legacy and heritage is here in the Netherlands, not far from where we're sitting, I think we've really developed this kind of unique European DNA, and we can have the agility, we can have the scientific expertise, but we also have that cost mindset. And that's really what it takes to win.
Well, you already did. Let's go to Synthon indeed. Tell me a little bit about Synthon. Let's start with the history, because it was differently structured some years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, Synthon was founded about 35 years ago by a scientist. And the whole idea was to really start looking into this whole generics industry. And 35 years ago was still, you know, I would say that the market was forming and people were really understanding what kind of positive impact can generics have. And the founder, incredibly smart scientist, but also had a very, very keen mind to understanding intellectual property, started this company with a few partners. And over the years, just one success after another, was able to build the company up to what it is today. And today we're really a global pharmaceutical company. We've got over 1,500 employees around the world. We have four manufacturing sites, and we are really known as the development engine for complex generics serving the market.
And because that's your unique selling point, so to speak. And so there's complex generics, So what's a complex generic?
That's right. So complex generics, it's back again to that whole portfolio idea, that how do you operate in a market that is fiercely competitive? And I think this is the same in all industries. You have to figure out what you're good at, and you have to really invest in the right people and the right talent to differentiate yourself. And in our world, in the world of generics, our differentiation comes from these more difficult to make, more difficult to formulate, complex generics. And that could be generics that are used for treating cancers, different types of cancers, prostate cancer, breast cancer. It could be drugs to treat multiple sclerosis or different neurological diseases. But it always has to have something in the way the product is developed, the way it's manufactured, the way it's tested, or the way it has to be administered, that makes it a bit more difficult to do so that others can't do it. And that's really what our USP or unique, selling point is.
But it must be better than many other generic companies who have the same approach or not.
Well, lots of people try. At the end of the day, these are generics. So there's always going to be different people who try and do it, right? It's very different from the whole innovative market where you have walls and walls of barriers protecting your product through patents, through data exclusivity, through different, regulatory and legal frameworks. I think in this situation, the assumption is that, look, we're all driving towards the same thing, which is let's make the medicine more affordable, more accessible, and let's treat more patients. And I think as an industry, we are absolutely harmonized in our thinking there. But when it comes to where we play and how we play, this is where Synthon has kind of come out a little bit different. And while others do try and do this whole complex generics thing, I think we do it better than the rest. And there's a few different reasons. I think one is back to our kind of our Dutch heritage of being very scientifically focused and scientifically driven. We're just better at the science. We can do it more effectively with a higher success rate. I think the other thing is the manufacturing. I mentioned before, we have two manufacturing sites here in Europe, and we have two manufacturing sites in Latin America. And the combination of those really allows us to get some cost competitiveness out of Latin America. It allows us to get kind of onshore treatment here in Europe. And we've set it up in a way where these factories are kind of interchangeable. So we have built-in security, which is really what our customers want, right? They want to know that when there's more demand or there's something that happens, Synthon can still provide that medication.
So all of your factories can actually produce all the products that you have in your portfolio.
Yeah, so the whole strategy is around dual sourcing and having that security of supply. So that's something that we really think about to minimize these disruptions. And you mentioned shortages before. I mean, shortages are bad for business, but more importantly, they're bad for patients. I mean, it's a tragedy when you hear about, antibiotics or other life-saving therapies that are not available because nobody can make money. And these companies are redeploying that capacity or those factories to do something else in order to pay the bills. And that's a real problem. And again, this is where the industry is trying to work with Medicines for Europe to try and really advocate for different kinds of pricing models and sort of different frameworks to say, look, everyone knows the point of generics is that prices should be more affordable, no question. But you have to have a floor, where it's still achieving the purpose that it's intended for, which is making these products available and accessible for patients.
Yeah. And how many of these complex generics do you have?
We have about 75 different products in our portfolio today.
And all of your factories can produce those?
Well, the factories specialize in different things. So two of the factories make the API or the active pharmaceutical ingredient, and two of the factories make the drug product. So they're interchangeable across each, you know, each one of those, yeah.
And then, so you produce those these complex generics, and then to whom do you sell them? Who are your customers?
Yeah, so we operate a B2B business. So we're really a business-to-business company. So if you go to the pharmacy in any of these countries, in Europe or the U.S., you never see Synthon on the box. So our customers are the other generics companies. So you can think of large generics companies like a Teva or a Sando, you know, these are the ones that are globally known and that are the absolute leaders in the generics field. Generics, biosimilars, and other products as well. Now, these companies work with us because some of the products they can't do on their own. And some of the products, they just make a strategic choice to say they're going to deploy their resources and their capacity towards other types of things, but they're still interested in making these products available. And that's created this industry, again, back to the point of collaboration and doing things together in the whole generics industry, it's created the opportunity for companies like Synthon for us to develop and manufacture the products but not sell them into the end market. So it's a really nice model that we've kind of fleshed out.
So you have a very limited number of customers, I assume.
We have a very large number of customers.
Oh, a very large number, okay.
So again, because of our model and the types of complex generics we have a lot of demand from a lot of customers around the world. So we're selling to...
And you don't have not many competitors?
In some cases, we don't have many competitors. In some cases, we do. And this is, again, you know, the idea of the harder to make products, the more difficult the requirements are, the more expensive the investments are, they generally will tend to have less competition. And again, that's then for us, it's finding the balance between, you know, we get those products into the market through our partners, we make it affordable, but the prices don't come down to unsustainable levels. And that's really the right kind of equilibrium that companies like Synthon try and find. It's of course, we're a profit-driven organization, we're privately held, but we're a purpose-driven and a mission-driven company as well. And when you can find that balance of having these difficult products that are made more affordable, but you can still have a sustainable profit level, that's really what we're trying to achieve.
And are you successful?
We've been very successful. I would say over the last 35 years, the company has consistently grown. I joined the company in 2021, and I have to say I've got an incredible team of people around me. I was fortunate enough to come into a company that already had three decades of history and legacy and just people knowing what to do and knowing what good looks like. So when I was asked to take on this role, for me, it was very exciting for a lot of reasons. One, Synthon's always been the leader in this space of developing and manufacturing complex generics. So for me, the job was to say, how do we make it even better, right? How do we go from good to great? And that was a really interesting, you know, kind of a mandate for me.
So how did you do that then? Did you look again at manufacturing efficiencies or things like that?
Yeah, so we looked at a number of things. We operate in an enormous environment. So the generics industry is around $250 billion a year. So it's a big industry, and it's growing. It has been growing at 4% over the last 5 years, and it is expected to grow at 6% over the next 5 years. And again, it's driven by more products coming off patent, larger products coming off patent, more complex products coming off patent, and then just the fundamental dynamics of market access, right? We take it for granted a bit in Europe or the US that if you need to see a doctor, you can go see a doctor. If you need medication, you get a prescription, you can go to the pharmacy. Most of the world doesn't work that way. It's still a lot of high payment out of pocket. Access to physicians isn't always easy. medications aren't always available, and there's a low level of disease awareness. So as more countries, you know, industrialize, access increases, awareness increases, the market's growing. So we play in this huge, very attractive market, fulfilling, I think, a mission critical role, because without generics, people wouldn't be able to get the drugs they need, because the innovative products are very expensive. So we kind of looked at that. We step back and look at the big picture and say, is there more opportunity than we're going after now? Do we have the right people, the right capabilities, the right ambition? And we did a bit of a strategic exercise with our investors, and we said, you know what, we need to do a few things. Number one is we want to invest more. We want to actually spend more money. And counterintuitive, right? Spend more money, but we're going to spend more to make more. And we're going to spend more, and we're going to really ramp up our R&D activities. And we're going to double the number of products we work on. We're going to add more people. We're going to add more equipment. And we're going to really set an ambition of bringing more products to market in the future. So that was the first thing we did. The second thing we did was looking at efficiencies, like you said. So we looked at our factories and said, are we running these factories that have a real competitive advantage of being in Europe or in Latin America, not in the Far East? Are we running them in the best way we can? And we realized that we weren't. So we brought some additional people in, and we started really focusing on what they call operational excellence, procurement, all of those things to say, whatever you do, can you do it better? Can you do it more efficiently? Can you reduce waste and scrap and limit the downtime you have? And we started lots of programs like that. And the third thing we did was really on more of the commercial side. We said, you know, we're an enabler of our customers' growth, right? We're all about helping them get more products so they can sell more and they can grow. So we said, are we really being aggressive enough? Are we going out to enough customers? And you asked me the question before, we probably have 200 customers around the world. We sell in maybe—
And these are other pharmaceutical companies, other, right? Other generic companies. Right?
Other generic companies, yep. Other pharmaceutical companies, generic companies. Some may be global, like the names I gave you. Mm-hmm. Some may be regional. Some may be local. So we really work with the whole gamut of these companies. And again, we think about, is there a need in the market for what we do? And if there's a need in the market, then we go and find these customers, and we work together on how we can bring it to market. So putting all those three things together is really what's allowed us to grow tremendously. So we're growing on our top line, you know, more than twice what the market is growing. And we have an improved sort of profitability profile as well. And all of that, to be honest, that's just a lagging indicator. Like we talk about financial results because we're a privately held company. But when I talk to our employees, our colleagues, right, all of our 1,600 colleagues around the world, we talk about our purpose, our mission, and these sorts of initiatives we do. And when you do them right, when you focus on the values, like we're scientifically driven, we're customer oriented. When you talk about values and behaviors and competencies, and you do those things right, the output is growth. And so the growth for us comes second. And then the growth allows us to invest more in more people and more technologies and work on more products. Then we're going to grow more. So it's always, I think, about getting on this virtuous cycle. And if you get on the virtuous cycle, you can do more. And then it becomes fun. And we really take pride in being a great place to work. We've won lots of awards for it. We have a culture where people celebrate together. We, you know, it's one of these, I was at an employee breakfast meeting today. I do these small group meetings with colleagues just to hear from them. What's on your mind? What can we do better? What are we doing good at? And one of the answers that I always love to hear is people love Synthon because of the people. It's, you know, it's all about the people you work with. And when you work with great people who are like-minded and motivated, right, you can be successful.
You're still living in London, but the headquarters of Synthon is here in Nijmegen. How do you cope with that?
Yeah. I spend a lot of time on planes.
Right.
You know, post COVID, there was a temporary period where people stopped traveling and everything moved to Teams and virtual. And, you know, you and I had our first meeting virtually, and now we're sitting together in the room. And honestly, it's so much better to sit together in the room. I think at the end of the day, business is still about people, and it's still about having a cup of coffee together, sharing a story or two. So I spent a lot of time on the plane, but Synthon is a global company. So I'm on the road a lot, either here in Nijmegen or our manufacturing sites or visiting customers or going to conferences. It's really about being out there, understanding the market, the competition, the customers, that allows me to bring these insights back and share it with the team, and other people are out running around doing the same thing, and that allows us to always refine our strategy.
Your previous company was for Theramex, a British company. So now you're in a Dutch company. So how do you cope with that? That's a big difference, isn't it?
It's a big difference, but you know, look, every culture is different and every culture has its nuances. I have to say, what I really appreciate about the Dutch culture is the transparency, the directness. You know, I'm American.
Rudeness.
You could say rudeness at times, but let's stick to the positive ones about it. I'm an American. Americans are pretty direct as well. Like we're there's a few famous Americans now. They're maybe too direct, but I appreciate knowing where things stand and how people feel. And if they don't agree, say it. You know, there's lots of cultures in Europe where, or not just Europe, but around the world where that doesn't happen. And I think those are difficult to navigate. So me coming over here, it's a transition, of course, but again, I'm a people person. So I spend a lot of time going to dinners and spending time with people and understanding how things work and why things are done the way they are. And I think once you invest the time, at the end of the day, people across all cultures are the same. I mean, the colleagues become friends. And when you're thinking about the same things together, you can make progress.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Anish, for coming here and for giving this story about generics companies and about the success of Synthon. It's doing very well. So again, thanks a lot for coming here. And you, wherever you are, thanks for listening. And I'll see you next time. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Dit was Leaders in Life Sciences. Vond je iets van deze aflevering? We horen graag jouw feedback. Wat houdt jou bijvoorbeeld bezig? Of over wie zou jij meer willen horen? Laat het weten via een Apple of Google review. Of stuur een berichtje via social media. Of natuurlijk gewoon per mail. Onze waardering is groot. Tot slot nog dank aan onze partners. Dat zijn Pivot Park, Johnson & Johnson Innovative Medicine en Pedersen & Partners Executive Search.